Once upon a time, a glorious World Trade Center stood tall and strong, the center of Manhattan. But after September 11th, 2001,
American life completely changed.
Fast forward to the present. We live in a world where police use sonic weapons and tasers on unarmed citizens during public assembly. Federal prisoners might be allowed counsel for a trial. And warrantless wiretaps apply to the average U.S. citizen.
Hello!
And when you opened your eyes today, you just might have been waking up Orwell. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily the views and opinions of blogtalkradio.com or those of the sponsors of Waking Up Orwell.
Hey, guess what we're doing today here on Waking Up Orwell? We're going to take a little detour. And we're going to stop in and talk with my good friend, Dave Weingarten. We're going to call it a water cooler talk, and I think you'll get the reason why once we move into the interview. Just come with me on this journey. You'll get it. It's stuff you need to know. Okay, we're going to be talking today with Dave Weingarten. He is a researcher, reporter, writer, broadcaster, and videographer for some civil liberty issues and social justice in Canada. He's producing a film called Fortress Toronto. It's a documentary about Canada and the G20. For more information about the film, please visit www.fortress-toronto.com. Dave, are you with us?
I'm here. Thanks for having me, Sheila.
All right. So one of the reasons I invited you to come in and comment on what's going on in Canada is because there was a meeting this Monday, November 13th, the trilateral continental leaders were getting together. It was supposed to be Felipe Calderon, Stephen Harper, and Obama, but you said Calderon didn't make it because some sort of dignitary went down in flames in a plane crash or something.
That's what I've heard. I believe so. I think he had to return back to Mexico. A few officials in the government were killed in a plane crash, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's kind of strange. The timing's kind of weird, but there was a 30-point plan for U.S. and Canadian and possibly Mexican border policy that was going to go out on the 13th, but it never made it out of the media gate. And so they've pushed the release date for this 30-point plan until December of 2011. And I'd like to talk a little bit about that 30-point plan. There's a demand for biometrics, some border fence building and construction in Canada. A lot of the policy that came from a 2002 document put up on the DHS website, a lot of that policy has kind of been absorbed into something called the Real ID Act. So it's more or less legal in terms of like the biometrics and the border policy. And so some of it can be manipulated via fiat administration, agency administration, but not all of it. And I guess they have to talk to each other because it's two different nations. It's going to affect two different nations. But I guess the kernel of the news here is that they're going to integrate the intelligence sharing between the two nations. And I don't know if you know this, but that includes your health record information, and it also includes basically whatever counts as intelligence in the United States. Right now, there is a huge run on anything digital, meaning like if you walk in front of a CCTV camera in four states, they're trying a pilot program where they can biometrify any image, you know, relate that maybe to the United States internet, and find photos of you, compare the images, and kind of like capture you. Capture your identity and, you know who you are if you walk in front of a government CCTV camera in one of these four states. And one of them is Washington State, very close to the Canadian border. And, you know, that's a really scary prospect because you don't have to have an FBI profile to be profiled anymore. And I think that's true of most anything. You've got the CIA watching tweets and hacking into tweets because of people like Brigitte Jahn's daughter, who's tweeting and working with WikiLeaks. Department of Justice went behind the conventions they normally do, and they said, yeah, we're going to green light the access to Brigitte Jahn's daughter's Twitter records. That was a defeat for privacy in the United States. And there's stuff like that going on all the time now. So that's the atmosphere over here in the United States and the way that they're behaving towards privacy. If that were carried over to, say, like, Canada, what are your concerns?
Well, I think when I was covering for this upcoming film, Fortress Toronto, when we were in Toronto filming and the city was locked down, it had almost literally become a fortress. There were fences up, additional CCTV cameras were brought in, and that was a really rough week for people in the city. They were being searched and asked for their ID, and that invasion of your privacy and that assumption that your image can be recorded for no particular reason, that your ID can be checked for no particular reason, your bag could be checked. I think that's all symptomatic of that culture, of that 1984 culture, the all-seeing eye, the ever-pervasive surveillance on citizens. I don't think it necessarily prevents crime. I think there are studies showing the opposite, in fact, that it is no deterrent at all. But for some reason, it's important to the powers that be that they have all this information. You're categorized, you're time-stamped, they know where you are, your GPS. It doesn't prevent crime. There could be some other nefarious motive at work here. But in the end, I'd say if the information is not required, I don't think that they should be doing it. And we saw just how, in Canada anyway, just how extreme it can be taken, how bad it can be for the citizens of the country when that happens. Surveillance was extremely pervasive on all the organizers, the activists. They knew who to pick up, who to arrest at these protests. They had them under surveillance. Informants were implanted into the groups. And when no actual crime was committed, people were rounded up, accused of ridiculous charges, conspiracy charges, or maybe planning to perhaps conspire to commit a crime. It was like 3 degrees of conspiracy that you were conspiring to conspire. You know, people got snagged up in this dragnet, and it didn't prevent crime. It did prevent people from voicing their opinions, though, and protesting legitimately and peacefully. And that could be the aim in the end of this all-pervasive surveillance, is that it's not to prevent crime, it's not to make us safer, it's to shut us up, and to know where and when we're going to be there in order to do it more easily.
So you're saying the name of the game is to have that chilling effect.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a byproduct of it, intentional or not. And it does have a chilling effect. You know, when the G20 was over and the CBC, our national broadcaster, came out with their documentary, and it was even titled, unfortunately, it was entitled "You Should Have Stayed at Home."
And that's bad.
Yeah,
that's bad.
That was the name. It might have been an ironic. They might pass it off as though, oh, they were using it in some sort of a, you know, ironic sense or something like that, but that was the atmosphere. And I think a lot of people that we interviewed, they knew many people who had left the city to avoid this scenario, this atmosphere of 1984.
So have they carried over the, because there has been a rumor amid some of the activists who were there during the protest, that those policies have kind of stuck around, that they weren't just like a shock the day or week of the G20, that they stuck around, and now it's just kind of like policy that is the new normal. Can you comment on that?
Well, there were temporary laws that were put in place, or supposed laws, that we were told within 5 meters of the convention meeting place you could be searched without a warrant, you know, that somehow extended to the parks and the streets throughout the city where anybody was, not just 5 meters within the convention center, but it spread to throughout the city. And I think that highlighted just how, you know, I firmly believe that the people have a lot of power, but it really unfortunately highlighted just how, to what extent, the authorities can take advantage of our assumption they're doing the best thing possible for us. Of course, in the end, it turned out that there was no law, that the law the police chief was invoking really didn't have that caveat that you could search people with no impunity throughout the city unlawfully. But we just sort of took it for granted. This is what the police were doing at the time. And though there was no legal basis for it, in the end, a lot of people submitted. And we saw a lot of people who would put up a good fight with the police. No, you can't search my things, you know. And through their wording or their twisting of words, you know, they would find their way into the person's bag. And in the end, sure, just search my bag, you know, so that I can be on my way. But it shouldn't be that way. And, you know, a lot of people think maybe that was a test, a pilot, you know, for maybe future laws that could be enacted. And who knows? You know, it's very possible there's a push right now to reinvoke two anti-terrorism provisions which were struck from Canadian law 5 years after 9/11. And there's a big push to bring those back now. So it worries me that once these things are codified and once they're in law, or written in law, to what extent will they use these powers, I wonder.
This 30-point plan that's being kind of hidden, I want to talk to you a little bit about the fact that it is hidden. There are a lot of Americans who don't get Canadian television, they don't get Canadian media, but the only place this 30-point plan is being discussed at all, as far as English-speaking countries, is being discussed in Canada. Do you want to speak to that?
The only thing I can really speak to that is if it is being covered in Canada, it's being covered very scarcely because I've seen nothing of it, really. I tell you, it can be depressing watching a lot of news sometimes and all the bad stuff that happens and the horrible plans that they're implementing to enslave us further, but I think I still try to keep an eye on the news, and I don't hear people really discussing this, or if they do, it's in passing, as though it's accepted. And we've got sort of this trifecta of governments: the Harper government, what was the Bush government, is now the Obama government, which, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, doesn't look too different from the Bush administration.
Same stuff, different day.
That's it, right? It's a different face on the same sort of hierarchy, but you know, so I'll call it a conservative, an access of conservatism, although I know Obama's a Democrat, right, and but I'll still use that term, the conservative access, and you have these people who are more than willing to you know, say the issue's not covered in the United States. I don't see any big push in Canada for it to be covered, and if it is, it's in passing as though it's already accepted, you know. And then that's unfortunate that there's not given more of a critique of it in the media, that it's not subjected to criticism and analysis as widely as it should be.
So what is your position on the idea of North American integration, an integration where basically we're sharing our intelligences, whatever that is, with Canada, and say your health records, anything that Canada deems intelligence in terms of domestic surveillance with us?
My opinion, it's a horrible idea, and I think it's unfair to the citizens of any country involved. And although these things may be codified in law one day and it will be official and that will be considered the end of it, you know, until the people really put up a fuss, although it will...
Okay, so we've suffered just a very brief interruption. We were talking with Dave Weingarten for Fortress Toronto, and he was discussing the chilling effects of some of the laws and the potential codification or lawmaking that would bring back more of a, I would say it was a pretty repressive type of governance to Canada when the connection was basically briefly snapped off mid-sentence. And so I wanted him to continue. So I have him back on the line, so I'm going to rejoin the conversation. Hey, Dave?
I'm here.
Okay. So continue with your thoughts.
Well, I think I don't know where I cut off there, but we were talking about the information sharing between countries, and I think we've clearly, you know, seen it illustrated how horribly wrong it can go in the case of Meher Arar, who was rendered to Syria, where he was tortured for a period of time, along with three other Canadians. And this was because the U.S. had rendered him, the Canadian government was complicit in this. And this all sort of went under the radar. Nobody knew about it. The families were obviously quite concerned, and it wasn't until they became vocal and went to the media that anybody started doing anything about it. But the thing that I would highlight in that issue is that when they were cooperating with the different governments and the different agencies, the families had no results. There was no recourse. There was nothing they could do. So you see how horribly wrong the sharing of information between these countries.
So we were cut off again in the span of 20 minutes. So we're trying a different line. I've now got Dave Weingarten on a second phone. This does happen occasionally. It's happened with other guests. But go ahead, Dave, about the information sharing agreement.
I would say look up the case of Meher Arar and just see how horribly wrong it can go. That someone can be sent off to Syria to be tortured for months, and three other Canadians as well, because of the information sharing that goes on. And that's unofficially, right? If this ends up becoming codified in law, and then they tell us we have no recourse, that this is law and this is final, then things could get really scary to a lot of people.
Do you think that that's one of the reasons why they say Americans are 75% in agreement with this?
That's news to me, and I would wonder what statistic they're citing, what the source of that information is, because I don't think you could find, you know, a group of people where 75% of them are even aware of what's in this document. So for 75% to be in agreement, I'd like to know how that's possible.
You know, I'm kind of curious myself, because no one's actually seen the current 30-point plan enough to greenlight it or say yes or no, up or down, because they're watching all the electronic communication. Obviously, they're probably watching this. The CIA is watching things like Twitter, and I'm thinking it went from the FBI watching Twitter to the CIA watching Twitter. And I think the reason why I went to the CIA watching Twitter is because that's extra national. So if the CIA were watching like any kind of tweeting between me and Brigitte Johnstadter for WikiLeaks in Iceland. So once you get into the CIA, there's a lot less transparency in the oversight. So once you go there, once you get into the extra national region of how the United States monitors and tracks and governs and that sort of thing, it gets a lot less legal. They're the ones who are way in favor of clandestine and proxy wars and torture. And the United States people don't necessarily get to talk back to that. It's outside of us. How can I say this? They have their own money. They do so much in drug capital seizures that they self-finance. So they're kind of almost out of the range of accountability. So they kind of do what they want. And it's very tough for domestic Americans to kind of rein them in, because there's very little sunlight on what they're doing. So when that standard gets applied to, say, like, you and Canada in an integration, you know, how does that complicate your life?
Well, you know, I guess we'll never really know, and that's the scary thing about it, that it takes place under such a shroud of secrecy. There was communication between federal United States agencies and Canadian federal agencies prior and during the G20 protests, and at the behest, I believe, of foreign governments, meaning the American government, the CIA perhaps, protesters were approached and sort of threatened said, that chilling effect, the fact that somebody does even come up and talk to you and say, we know these are your activities, we know you're planning on organizing or protesting, at the behest of other governments to go and to warn people off like this, I think it's horrible, and I think it's a violation of our right to assembly and our right to free speech. And I'll say this, it's interesting you talk about the responsibility of Twitter monitoring going from the FBI to the CIA. Perhaps it takes a whole new importance whether or not social movements influence the Arab Spring overseas and the various revolutionary activities that are going on. Perhaps these social media networks take on a whole new importance with now the Occupy protests in many big cities in North America. You know, maybe it gives them then the reasoning, you know, to be in charge of that now. And you're right, with little to no accountability.
The only thing that American citizens can do is hope and pray and self-advocate that the electronic privacy regulations in this country or laws get upgraded so that they cover things like phones and telecommunications. I know that EFF, the ACLU, EPIC, and other civil libertarian groups are working very hard, but they're inundated right now, and there's a new one every week. Or, you know, the FBI gets really bold here, and they want craftsmen access to computer technology. They ask tech manufacturers to build in surveillance capability so that it's more convenient for them to access it. I mean, that's how bold it's getting. The lens or the discrimination over what's criminal and what's not criminal is being interpreted, at least from my end. If you oppose an oppressive, you know, regime that wants to surveil everything you do, well, then you're our enemy. And I guess that's a carryover from the Bush administration that we hoped would change. But unfortunately, it's just gotten more entrenched and more emboldened, so that the fight is now becoming quite obvious. And they're taking us on in the electronic forum through data valence. And that's why this talk between you and I is so important, because the American media will not cover this. The only way for me to have found out anything about an American 30-point plan was for me to watch Canadian news. True story.
I'd say you're watching Canadian news pretty hard, because I still haven't seen any significant coverage of it in the Canadian media at all. And, you know, the problem is we're one of the most media concentrated countries on Earth. And I imagine that is pretty similar to the case in the United States. So there is a limit to where we can find this information, and you're right, it is important that people like yourself, people who are not in the mainstream, who are not owned by a corporation, that they do voice these dissenting opinions, because if these are the only places we can hear them, then it's important that we hear them, at least to form our own decisions based on the facts that we can present.
The Canadian perspective on intelligence sharing, a 30-point plan that we haven't seen, and the chilling effects of G20 extra national surveillance. So Dave Weingarten, Fortress Toronto, give us a shout about your film. Tell us a little bit about what's in it and where to watch it and where to look for it.
You can look for it around June 2012. It'll be the 2-year anniversary of the 2010 G20 summit in Toronto in Canada. And what we've done, we've interviewed a wide range of experts on various fields, the economy, labor, environmental issues, social activism. So there's a great range of interviews of people telling us what the issues were at the G20, really. And then we'd like to show how, through the media, through the federal government, and perhaps other federal governments, those messages were completely trampled. So no issues really ended up getting discussed at this summit, but the summit became a circus unto itself, with the street theater, with the burning police cars, with the location, which made it extremely dangerous and thus required the immense amount of security, the enormous amounts of security that were involved. These are all really self-engineered problems by the federal government. And in the end, whether intended or not, it served to overshadow the issues that were being presented. But we also, we have a lot of great interviews in this film. We have an RCMP informant, former RCMP informant, who was willing to be interviewed for this film. We talked to social activists whose groups were infiltrated by government informants a year and a half in advance of the summit. So this is before anybody knew that there was going to be a summit in Toronto, before anybody knew that the G20 summit was going to be here. These groups were already infiltrated, and it was the evidence that these informants had collected prior to any dealings with the G20 summit. It was on the basis of that evidence that these suspects were arrested. So it really was a sideshow in many, many ways, and that's what we would hope to show with this film and that people will take away from it.
Okay. Dave Weingarten, Fortress Toronto. Look for it in June of 2012. Thank you so much for your time and for joining us here on Waking Up Orwell.
Thank you, Sheila.
Okay, so that was pretty revealing. I'm going to pull up some news from beatthechip.org, the primary news sponsor for Waking Up Orwell. You can always check out reposted, recasted news over at wakinguporwell.info. That is the show's site. I very seriously doubt you're going to get this coverage anywhere else at this point, especially based on what happened this afternoon with that interview. So here's what's going on. I think Waking Up Orwell needs to take it to the next level for many reasons, but specifically the fact that Real ID is not going away. It's advancing databases and data valence. It's not just Real ID anymore either. It's fusion centers. It's corporate data valence. DHS advancing all these little programs with the TSA and passenger name recognition information. And all of it seeming to go into one dump space that is going to be the database state. And that would be the U.S. database state, but I think the idea was kind of imported from Europe somewhere. I might guess that it might be the U.K., because they're fighting with that themselves. But I would say that it's probably a Stasi-derived idea. So I was talking to Joshua Hart, and I was trying to tell him that I think what's going on is that the banking industries are hemorrhaging. And what they're doing is they're societally conditioning us to try to pay for things with our data. And I've had a kind of a notion about this for a while, but then I found a news item about it. Okay, I got this news piece from Slashdot, and Slashdot's been great. But this says, Aussie bank wants to trade social network data for better deals. An Australian bank has raised the possibility of offering better deals to customers who share its social network activities with it. But at the same security conference at which Commonwealth Bank's CIO made the suggestion, another speaker, security guru Bruce Schneier, warned of the dangers of vendor lock-in. Would you trust your bank or any institution to be the gatekeeper for your private data and thoughts in return for a cheaper mortgage or percentage points off your credit card? It's an important question. Well, probably not, but I'm thinking they probably want to get a hedge in the industry before that is exactly where it lands. So this is kind of my weird prognostication at work that data is going to become the new money. So watch out. Bruce Schneier's volleying a warning here that our economics and our markets are entertaining these ideas now, but this is kind of proof. And so, you know, be mindful. You know, your data ain't money, and it belongs to you and no one else. But there may be a move to try to take that and reorient it so that they own your data and you don't, and they end up owning you because you are your data. So be careful. There's a great article on beatthechip.org that says, who owns your data really? And then it takes you to a very well-researched piece where somebody wants to explain to us who really owns your data. And the shortcut is for me to tell you, you own your data. But, you know, as I'm having casual conversations with people, we're all under the same understanding that if you were to try to retrieve all your data from, say, Microsoft or Twitter or even Google, what would happen is that that would stop their wheels cold because they need that data. And if you were to pull that property out of the machinery, it would wreck it. So your data is actually very powerful. And there's power in the transactions. So the tech industry is a lot like the banking industry in the effect that they need to be transactional to be relevant. And that's more relevant, say, for banking than the tech industry, because the tech industry is going to produce data and inventions and, you know, renew itself, and they're more idea-driven and innovative than, say, the banking industry. The banking industry needs innovation. They need new ideas in order to survive. And they will need technology, and they adopt technology like the rest of the society. But it's different. They want your identity more than anyone else because they're demanding that right now, and you know your customer policies. And so you've got this kind of tertiary relationship where it's not enough that you show up with cash or money or a check. You have to also provide identity. So it's another form of indirect or legal tender. You cannot do exchanges in commerce without this identity requirement. And they want to pull this particular standard into the internet. That's what National Strategies for Trusted Identities in Cyberspace, or NSTIC, is about. So don't buy into this stuff. They want that data. And you know what? They don't deserve any more power. These toads need to go off the cliff. You know, if it's going to hemorrhage, let it hemorrhage and die. Here's a good reason. This is what happens when they get power. Okay, I'm going to read you a bit from the newspaper. Washington State. Anti-camera initiative sponsors seek rehearing in court. Sponsors of an initiative banning traffic cameras in Redmond, Washington, want a judge to reverse a decision blocking their access to the ballot. Although the city council in Redmond, Washington, has decided to cancel its red light camera contract, the city continues to block the effort to let voters have a say in the decision. In court papers filed Monday, local activists cited election results in the cities of Bellingham, Longview, and Monroe to convince King County Judge Laura C. Inveen to reconsider her October 11th ruling that it would be a useless act to put an advisory measure on the ballot. Under the local initiative process, the city clerk had a clear duty to transmit the petition to the county auditor. Judge Inveen ruled, that mandamus will not lie to compel the useless act of transmitting the initiative to the county auditor, where the initiative is invalid according to the Court of Appeals' recent decision, American Traffic Solutions versus Bellingham. On September 14th, local activists Scott Harlan and Tim Eyman submitted petitions containing 6,000 and 50 signatures, calling for a vote on a red light camera and speed camera ban. Though the number of unverified signatures was more than sufficient, Redmond refused to transmit the petition to the county auditor for validation of the signatures, with Inveen's approval. Daniel Quick, attorney for the initiative sponsors, argued that refusal to process a petition violates the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution and Article 1 of Washington State Constitution. What happened here? Well, what happened is that Redmond and the city of Redmond is getting some kind of kickback, either federal or probably federal, for having those red light cameras right where they are. they're getting a kickback, and there's tax money, and there is private and corporate money coming to the city for the cameras. So there's a public-private interest in the surveillance piece of this. And I scream about it on every single show. But there was a lobbyist involved. Someone who bought that judge. And who bought the press office in Linwood. And bought the mayor of Redmond, Washington. You know, all of those people have red light camera money in their back pockets. And they're paid to do what the red light cameras tell them to do. I hate to put it that way, but that's what Big Brother says. And this is a town that obeys Big Brother, Redmond, Washington. It's a problem. Here's another problem. Police crackdowns on Occupy Wall Street coordinated among mayors, FBI, and DHS. Oakland Mayor Jean Kwan let slip in an interview with the BBC that she had been on a conference call with the mayors of 18 cities about how to deal with Occupy Wall Street as a movement. That is, municipal authorities appear to be conspiring to deprive Americans of their First Amendment rights to freedom of assembly and freedom to petition the government for redress of grievances. Likewise, a Homeland Security official let it slip in a phone interview that the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security had been strategizing with cities on how to shut down Occupy Wall Street protest. The FBI is said to have advised using zoning ordinance and curfew regulations to stage the crackdown with massive police force at a time when the press was not around to cover the crackdown. Wonkett suggests that the Patriot Act is implicated here, but I'm not sure how that actually works, says Juan Cole. Actually, the techniques discussed are standard for U.S. police forces in dealing with peaceful protests. The only routine technique missing is that putting saboteurs among the protesters who cause destruction and create an image of them is violent. It's an old COINTELPRO tactic, but it's been pretty active recently. Let's go back to beatthechip.org for a minute. I'm going to read a little bit of a letter from an ACLU technology warrior. Whoop, whoop! Chris Calabrese. You deserve to be famous. He is the technology council over there. And he wrote this blog, "Oversharing is never a good thing, especially when it's DHS." So this is what he had to say. He said, "Sometimes sharing is bad. Don't worry, we don't plan to rush into kindergartens across America and break the news to all the five-year-olds, but it's true, especially when it comes to national security and your privacy. It may be necessary to collect and use certain information, but wrong to share it." When a federal government advisory committee recently revealed that the Department of Homeland Security, which contains both Secret Service and the TSA, is in the process of creating a policy framework and technology architecture for enhancing DHS's information sharing capabilities, it immediately raised these types of concerns, and today we sent a letter to DHS outlining those concerns. At this point, the details are very scarce, but we do know DHS is 230,000 employees collect enormous amounts of information every day. A small sampling includes benefit information from the Federal Emergency Management Agency, traveler information from the Customs and Border Patrol and TSA, work history from the E-Verify program, permit and payment information from the Coast Guard, naturalization records from the Citizenship and Immigration Service, and personal information like your social security number, date of birth, email address, from a wide variety of sources. All of this sharing raises a host of possible concerns. We have already seen breaches from these systems, raising concerns over identity theft. In 2009, one DHS program, E-Verify, accidentally allowed unauthorized individuals to gain access to the social security numbers of and other information about more than 37,000 people. Other DHS programs have been criticized for how they use computer analysis called data mining. Earlier this year, government auditors identified a series of problems with DHS databases and concluded, until such reforms are in place, DHS and its component agencies may not be able to ensure that critical data mining systems used in support of counterterrorism are both effective and that they protect personal privacy. Many DHS systems contain information which is incorrect or wildly prejudicial. Suspicious activity reporting, or SARS programs, like the America's Waterways Watch program, or the See Something, Say Something, encouraging the reporting of innocuous activities like photography or operating a boat with no apparent destination as a suspicious behavior to the Coast Guard or other DHS components, even though there is no reasonable basis to believe these commonplace activities indicate the occurrence of criminal or terrorist activity. Further dissemination of it, even to a limited extent, would dramatically exacerbate that problem and harm innocent people. Given all these problems, DHS shouldn't rush into any information sharing system, or ISE, for the technically non-impaired. The department must assess the necessity and scope of any program and to do so as part of an open and transparent process. Only then can the public decide whether DHS is using the information it gathers appropriately or oversharing it in a way that is likely to harm the privacy of every American. And that comes none too soon for considering an intelligence-gathering trade, a massive one, with another nation called Canada and possibly Mexico. So we got a problem in this area. So let's kick back to Real ID, because Real ID does need some attention. You know, there's a woman, her name is Kay Beach, and she's been the subject of some controversy because she actually lives in a state which adopted Real ID regulations into the driver's license, and now they're on that database train where you can't return. And she just said, forget it, I'm not going to do it. She pulled an Adrian Wiley, and it says here on Downsize DC, an Oklahoma woman named Kay Beach refused a Real ID compliant driver's license, primarily on religious grounds, which is something I did not know. Even though she has no criminal record, her inability to use state-issued IDs means she is now denied the following: prescription medications, hotel rooms, use of her debit card, and a P.O. box. So she is suing the state for its refusal to accommodate her religious beliefs, which is protected under the Oklahoma Religious Freedom Act. She's also suing the state for violating her right to keep her personal and unique biometric measurements and identification private. So Downsize DC has an action alert attached to this, and I'm going to add that to our do-it-yourself government piece. But it'd be getting worse, and every time you listen to this show, you'll learn something that you didn't know. This gives me a perfect opportunity to go ahead and pull in the smart meters talk, because that's definitely something that isn't getting enough coverage. Woo-wee! Boy, there's some information you really need to know about. So we've interviewed StopSmartMeters.org, and the executive director over there, his name is Joshua Hart. Stay with us after this short break. This is a mature listener advisory. The following mashup material is suitable for mature audiences only. Listeners are advised that the following content is not of a socially conservative nature. If this were a movie, it would have an MPAA rating of R. If you're not old or tolerant enough to gain admittance to this level rating, you're invited to skip this. Responsible adults may proceed on their own reconnaissance. Thank you for listening to Waking Up Orwell.
First guest today, and Congressman, you and I both know that money has a toxifying effect on the nature of the debate. Your thoughts on what you are witnessing around this country today?
Well, there's no doubt that you're on to something, because the money is a big deal. I deal with it on a personal sense, that money doesn't influence me, and most people know that. I don't get to pack money, and the lobbyists don't come and bother me. But, boy, I think this is it. People are sick and tired of it. But we have to look at the big picture too as well. Buys out the special interest, so we eventually have to deal with that too. But it is really sick, and we see a lot on the surface, but there is money in the underground as well. They
firms and other firms in the financial industry, they are the top industry donating to members of Congress and the President over the last 10 years with $2 billion. Now, what a return on investment. $2 billion put in and $700 billion bailout.
Thank you. if you have any questions about whether Washington lobbyists have disproportionate influence, too much influence, how many people in this room have a Washington lobbyist working for you? I see two, three. How many people are in the room? 1,500, 2,000? You are not represented by Washington lobbyists. You need to cut these people off.
Lots of Gaga on iTunes. So what was that speeding car that sounded like both news and music, and it was something what I call a mashup or a news mashup? If you hate it, definitely tell me, and I'll stop doing it. You know what time it is? It's time to talk about smart meters! Smart meters have become quite the news item these days. I'm actually dedicating this to my friends Susan and Tim, who put this back on my radar. So here are the few headlines that are coming across just today. Smart meters and dumb technocrats, and that was 2 hours ago from the Market Oracle. Maine Supreme Judicial Court to hear smart meter arguments. Stop smart meter program, says city. Over in England, it looks like it's BT to shave 13 million pounds off of energy meters with smart metering system, so that's kind of more in favor of it. Business innovation key to smart grid rollout. Killer smart meters torch Aussie homes. That's a bad idea. Smart meters spark privacy concerns. And that's within like the last day or two in the news cycle. This is just from Google. So, I brought an activist who's actually working on this issue, since things are kind of heating up and getting more testy between the public, the private sector, and whether or not this is truly a green energy idea that's going to work out. I have Joshua Hart from StopSmartMeters.org. Joshua, are you with us?
I'm with us. Thanks for having me on, Sheila. Appreciate it.
Joshua Hart is the director of StopSmartMeters.org, an organization fighting the forced deployment of wireless utility meters that harm health, violate civil liberties, and endanger public safety. He completed his master's in transportation planning at University of West England and has worked in the energy industry as an urban planner, environmental advocate, and a freelance journo. So welcome to the program, Joshua.
Thanks so much, Sheila. Yeah, this whole smart grid and smart program is truly Orwellian. It's really hurting people, and you know, every day I wake up and I wonder whether this has actually just been a really bad dream, and we're gonna wake up. But
why? Tell us exactly why it's so bad.
Well, if people aren't aware, what are being called smart meters, these are wireless utility meters being installed all over the country, all over the world, really, by utilities. And on the surface of it, you know, the utilities sort of say, oh, it's a great way to save energy and, you know, help the climate, and you'll know more about your electricity usage. But, of course, the devil's always in the details. And what these truly are control and surveillance devices that are able to inflict bodily harm. And have been on people since they've been installed. And they're also a fire risk, and it's a huge, huge theft of billions of dollars from tax money and from ratepayer money that should be going to renewables and to actually, you know, make communities more self-sufficient rather than dependent on the utilities. So that's sort of what we're facing. Thousands of people in California and other states have submitted detailed reports of their, in some cases, severe health effects from the meter. This is non-ionizing radiation, you know, same kind as your cell phone or Wi-Fi, but quite a bit stronger antenna that's used to connect and with each meter and convey your private data. And what these things are doing is they're pinging up to, as PG&E admitted to the Public Utilities Commission last week, you know, up to 190,000 pulses, you know, per day of radiation, of non-ionizing radiation. And this is radiation that the World Health Organization just labeled a class 2B carcinogen. There's evidence that this is really hurting plants and animals and natural systems as well as human beings. And to a lot of people, it feels like we're really under attack. So that's what we've been fighting across the country, you know, starting out here in California. And it's really, really spread. You know, we see, as you read the headlines just now, you know, Nevada Public Utilities Commission launching a major investigation into the health effects. Boulder, Colorado, saying, you know, we don't want your version of the smart grid. We don't want smart meters and dumping Xcel Energy, which is an investor-owned utility. So we're seeing, you know, basically the equivalent of the Hindenburg, just this whole balloon that's, you know, really the whole thing going down in flames, which is really, you know, shows the state of our regulatory system and government here in the U.S. So that's what's going on.
Well, I recognize that there's a variety of issues here. One of them is that there's privacy, and that's a large chunk of what we cover here on this show. Can you talk to us specifically about the privacy violations that are happening and where they're happening, how it happens, that sort of thing?
So, basically, smart meters are a telescope into the activities that happen within each home. And, you know, on your old, your traditional analog meter, you get a bill at the end of the month for all the electricity you've used, and they don't know when you use it or how you use it. You just get billed for the amount of energy you use. Now with the smart meters, they have a second-to-second report of every single appliance you use and when inside your own home. Every appliance has a certain electrical signature that they can basically read. So it can go down to the detail of what channel you're watching on television, for example.
Ooh.
You know, making Nielsen ratings unnecessary because they just have that data anyway. And, you know, Teresa's extraordinarily lucrative data for other appliance manufacturers,
oh, yeah.
for, you know, companies who want to sell you things, to health insurance companies. I mean, what we're talking about here is a system that's been designed in back rooms of appliance manufacturers and energy companies.
Marketing.
To have all of your appliances talk to each other wirelessly. So not only would your smart meter be pulsing, but your toaster, your microwave, your washing machine, your refrigerator would all be talking to each other and sending signals to the smart meter, which then would be passing all that information back to the utility, which could do what it wants with it, sell it or provide it to law enforcement, government agencies, third-party corporations. So, you know, with new fridges that are using RFID technology, have the ability to gather that data of, you know, what products you're using, how fast you're eating them, you know, what's going on in your fridge. For example, you know, it may seem like it's like, who cares if your utility knows you're, you know, blow drying your hair, but when you start to think about all the implications, you know, your health insurance company could monitor your, you know, how late you stay up at night, how many times you open your fridge at a certain time, what you eat even, and could use that data to justify an increase in your rates based on your unhealthy lifestyle when you might not even be aware that information is being transmitted. So.
Yeah, that's covert surveillance, and I'm sure that's probably illegal, but the ECPA hasn't been upgraded to a point where people can protect themselves. The data is generated. It can be purchased from a third party by a third party and kind of laundered because of how data is brokered today. Let me ask you an important question, which is very basic. How do people know that they're on a smart meter system?
Well, the only way to know really is with a radio frequency analyzer. But
what?
You know, to make sure that what you're dealing with is a wireless meter and that it's active, you can use a radio frequency analyzer. But generally, if you go outside and you look at your electrical meter, if it has a digital display and an FCC ID on the front, chances are more than likely that it is a smart meter, a not-so-smart meter. And if you still have the old style, the analog meter with the rotating disc, without an FCC ID, you have an old style, safer analog meter. So, you know, people have been chaining up their analog meters. They've been hiring electricians and directly, you know, removing smart meters from homes where they're causing health impacts.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, people are really rising up against this. They're not just taking it lying down, which is really good to see.
Yeah, that's really important to hear because let me explain to you kind of a little situation that I ran into recently where basically public sector begins to behave like the government when it behaves badly. We had a door-to-door waste service, which is rolled up in the rent and the utilities and everything. But we were told from the time that we came in the door that you cannot opt out of the service and that you will pay for it. And I'm thinking, that's a very odd thing to tell anyone, because if you pay for the a blanket cost for any kind of, like, waste removal service, you don't, you know, kind of put them under the gun and tell them, you must use this waste service. So we got to the point where, you know, we tried it out. You know, we left our you know, refuse and recycles outside. You know, we're pretty green. We try to be. Suddenly we started getting these little tickets, and written into the fine print on our lease is that if you get, like, up to 3 of these little tickets, if they just leave these, and this is a private company, that they can fine you $25 for garbage violations. Now what this became is that a garbage nanny came to us, inspected how we put out our refuse under this coercive agreement with our apartment complex, and then starts leaving these arbitrary tickets to say, okay, well, one of them was, garbage pickup comes out at 8 p.m. Well, we all know that. But they left a ticket. So you get more than three of these little things, and then they can start, you know, dinging you. And that's almost like a private metering maid service for your garbage.
That's outrageous. I mean, that's, I think what we're seeing is, like, you know, the corporations thinking that they're government.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big problem.
Yeah, and, you know, these things that we need, you know, we need garbage pickup, we need utility service, these things that are essential are, you know, basically they're using to extort money out of us. And that's one thing, you know, they're definitely doing that in California. There's a whole proceeding where, you know, you have these disabled people who can't even live in their home, and they're forcing them to pay, not only pay for the smart meter, but also for the analog meter being returned, you know, the utilities in California want to do. So it's really like them holding a gun to your head and saying, you know, give me some money and I'll take it away. You know, it's they know that they're inflicting an injury here and invading people's private lives and violating all sorts of, you know, standards on civil liberties, but they don't care. All they want to do is make a buck.
Well, I retaliated against the garbage nanny, and I took down my refuse can and said, look, you know, I realize that I signed here in the agreement that I must pay for this, but you're not going to force me to use your service. So here, you can take your little can, and, you know, I can do this myself. Thank you very much. Good night.
Absolutely.
Let's just say my building used a smart meter. How would I retaliate? Would I retaliate against the building? Would I retaliate against the company? Would I retaliate against the administrator and the community? How do you fight back? You're the guy to know.
Well, you can fight back, and people are, and the way to do it is to organize with your community, and to, like, it is particularly difficult in the case of an apartment building, because you have, you know, let's say you have 10 units, you have one person, and they have 10 meters or 20 meters, with including the gas ones, on their wall. So it's basically like an opt-out in that situation would be, you know, the whole building. I mean, what we really need to do is just, you know, demand collectively that they remove these things when, you know, if and when they're causing harm, and they are. And then, you know, if the utility company fails to do it, analog meters are freely available online, and changing it out, you know, although it's a dangerous, potentially dangerous thing, if you're dealing with a lot of electricity, is a relatively straightforward thing to do. You know, if you have a professional who knows what they're doing. So I think what we're beginning to see is, you know, a wave of direct action of people saying, you know, you got to take this thing off our property. It's hurting us, and if you don't, we're gonna take reasonable action ourselves to correct that situation. So that's, you know, that's basically, you know, what's going on. But it's important to fight the utility together, you know, to organize in your neighborhood or in your building, and have a united voice, because what they want to do is isolate people and then intimidate them and hope they'll go away, you know, and that works really well with elderly people, a lot of whom we've been hearing about have just absolutely been abused by their utility, you know, and at some point it's like, we got to stand up and say enough is enough. You know, they can't have, you know, gas pipelines that are burning people alive. And, you know, it's a pattern. And it's not just the RF. It's like not just the smart meters. It's the whole thing, you know. And we're seeing Boulder, Colorado reject XL Energy, which is its utility. And, you know, I think people are really beginning to wake up. But people do need to be aware, especially of the privacy implications.
How did you find out? How would you get a privacy impact statement from a smart meter company? Would they provide that? Have you ever done anything, gone through that exercise, and found out anything specific?
Well, it's really double talk that they're saying. They're saying, you know, if you ask them, like, oh, your private data is protected and it's, you know, secure and you know, there's restrictions on it. But, you know, a guy who worked for the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
This is Lee Tian, right?
So Lee, yeah, basically Lee was saying, you know, look, the privacy protections that are currently in place, are currently in the law, you know, are decades old, and it's like you're driving an old beat up VW Bug on a free, you know, at 40 miles an hour on a freeway with SUV with Suburbans going 90, you know. So those are the kinds of protections that we have against spying and privacy violations. And you know, I mean, they want to encourage use of the data. They want to, Commissioner Simon and the Public Utilities Commission in California said, we want to encourage the use of your private data by third parties to make money. I mean, that's what, you know, there's this whole industry that sprouted up around the smart grid and around, you know.
It's the data racket.
Yeah, that's, and they're all completely diluted in this, like, you know, money-soaked haze. You've got Silver Spring Networks, who's, you know, building all the communications equipment for this stuff based in Redwood City. And, you know, it's just another one of these bubbles that we've seen before. Like, the internet bubble is just gonna burst. And this one's going to be pretty ugly because you have, a ton of people really being hurt by this. You know, we're just getting inundated with calls. Another one this morning for a woman from Menlo Park visiting, you know, PhD to Stanford, suddenly found that she couldn't live in her house anymore because of her headaches and insomnia. And she knew it was because of the smart meter. And, you know, she's like, I need help. I don't know what to do. You know, what do you do? They become everywhere out here in California. So, you know, the effect on the electrosensitive and the infliction of pain and damage to health is really, really, you know, if you don't have health, it doesn't matter if your privacy is violated or if you're overcharged. You know, safety and health are really the bottom line here, and these meters are just are put the ability in the hands of the utility companies and the governments, who are basically working in tandem to inflict varying levels of health damaging carcinogen directly into your home.
What are the symptoms? What are the symptoms that these people are experiencing? And can you tell what the difference is? Do they notice right away, or, you know, did they start going to the doctor? Give us some examples.
I can tell you that, you know, that it's an increasing fact that more and more people are affected by it. You have some say between 5% and 8% of the population that's affected very badly right now, and another 30% who are mildly affected. You know, I started getting electrosensitive myself about 6 months ago.
Wow.
Whether it's, you know, we did an interview with a resident in Berkeley by a wall of 120 smart meters, and I think that, you know, the radiation just to it. I don't know where it came from, but all of a sudden, whenever I was around cell phones or cell towers, I would start getting a creeping feeling of nausea, and then in my head, my temple, like a sharp pain in my temples. And, you know, I was in the midst of the smart meter campaign, and so I thought that, you know, basically I'm just imagining it, or it's just, you know, something, it must be, you know, something I'm you know, some sort of empathy thing with the people I'm hearing from. But then, you know, a couple of things happened. Like, one night I was asleep on the train, and we were, it was dark out, couldn't see anything, and all of a sudden I got that pain in my temples, and I looked outside, and there was a huge cell tower right in a PG&E yard. And it's become really obvious. I mean, it's totally obvious. Like, if I walk by someone in the grocery store and they have one of these new smartphones, like, even if it's just on and it's pinging out to the cell tower, I can feel that, and I know whether they have a phone. So it's really kind of bizarre. You know, it's very unpleasant. It's limited where I can go, and it's limited where a ton of people can go. And, you know, we need to start speaking out about it, because it's just not okay. And the government is saying it doesn't exist. You know, medical professionals are divided. It's an increasingly controversial topic right now. You know, that everyone's talking about brain tumors and cell phones, and it's looking really likely, countries like Finland and Sweden, where they've used cell phones for a long time, they're seeing a spike in brain tumors now. I love my electronic devices. I love them. they're really fun, and you know,
and we need them. We need them.
People really need. Yeah, I mean, you know, arguably we don't need wireless, and we don't need the health effects that it has. But that, you know, we've been led to believe that the technology that we've been given is safe, and all the evidence, I mean, if you look at all the peer-reviewed science, really indicates that it's not safe. You know, people who are reporting these effects are increasingly, the media is not, mainstream media is not covering it, you know, and it's not a comforting thought to think that the stuff that's all around us is dangerous, but I think, you know, it can be used, and it probably is being used as a weapon. You know, this is a military technology. Cell phone technology came out of the military, and, you know, we've got to be very cautious of it. There are a widespread number of neurological, psychological, you know, biological effects of different frequencies and different modulations and different strengths. And we need to err on the side of caution when, you know, going forward and limiting access to this sort of technology. So it's pretty funny because 2 years ago I just thought all this was complete, you know, nuts. Like people talking about health effects of wireless, I thought they were tinfoil hat, you know, nuts. And I didn't think there was any substance to it. And the whole smart meter thing made me, you know, take the time to actually research and look into this issue. And you know, I now realize it's really serious. We've got to organize around it. We've got to fight it because their plan is to put, you know, cover the entire country, the entire world with towers so that the people who are electrosensitive have nowhere to go. Sorry.
You know, I think that my friend Susan Clark has done amazing work in this area. And for a woman who has really been kind of under the gun on the run, had her share of sufferings in contention with this invention, this particular invention. She's not on the good side of a lot of people who aren't really a friend of innovation. I mean, if you invent something and it's a great amenity to communication and humanity, that's fantastic. But the minute it becomes a health hazard, you know, well, let's find a way to fix it, because I've met a lot more people in the Bay Area who look at problems like when there's a problem with their technology, they just debug it or find a way to fix it or get around it.
Right.
You know, they don't dwell so much on the fact that they're overly attached to the marketing piece of it. They just, you know, say, oh, well, here's a problem. I'm gonna innovate around it so that we can, you know, offer something that's actually helpful.
It's like just because we can doesn't mean we should, right?
Absolutely. And the thing is the convention. So the stupidity kind of comes from, well, we're overly invested and we're attached to this process because it generates cash. And, you know, before regulatory folks start putting their paws in it, if people just kind of concede to the fact, well, okay, well, let's fix it. Let's make it a better invention. But I've found that you're in a good spot, you know, for the early adopters in the Bay Area who found, wow, this is a great way to like go into technology. But, you know, these are the same people who are, you know, identity and data brokers, and they're making so much cash from this that's where the fight is.
Yeah, hopefully the revolution will come before then.
Well, you are the revolution. You're part of the revolution, Joshua. How do people get started organizing? They're like, I'm just this teeny, weeny, tiny person who is like, you know, barely knows their rights, but I'm sick of this and I really don't agree with it.
Well, you know, we were just so outraged that PG&E was going to force this on our community that, you know, we just started knocking on doors and knowing your neighbors. I mean, I think we know our neighbors probably as well as we ever have in history, and it's really critical, you know, knowing your neighbors, having a community of people who know each other and stand up for each other is really critical. And you know, we just went door to door. We got petition signatures. We went to our city council. It happened to be before an election, so they were very sensitive to the community desire. We turned about 2 or 3 dozen people out to the meeting. The council passed one of the first you know, demands that the utility halt installation, and then it sort of snowballed. Now we have 47 local governments, cities and counties in California who've, you know, demanded a halt to smart meters and looked out for the community like that. So, and, you know, nevertheless, the utility keeps installing them against the law. And so at the end of the day, you need either people to take direct action, or you need a sheriff or a law enforcement official who's willing to stand up to the state and the utility. And, you know, that's tough. But the more that people do stand up and take a stand and just say, I'm not going to go along with this, you know, the better. You know, I think it's just you know, just not giving them the power, like, because they don't really have it at the end of the day. They, you know, the power is really with the people, and I think we know that. But getting over that hump to say, like, you know, a lot of people will call the utility and ask what their rights are when working with the utility and ask them, you know, if they have the right to remove the smart meter from their house. But when it comes down to it, it's you know, whether you're renting there and you're living there, or whether you own your property, you have a right not to have this device spying on you and affecting your health.
What are the tools that you have that you can give to someone to assert themselves?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think it's important to put yourself in a position of power with them and say, give them an ultimatum. For example, people in California have been saying, look, you know, if you don't remove this device from my home within 72 hours, I'm going to hire an electrician to correct the safety issue on my house. And you know, I do not consent to my house being used as a telecommunications facility.
Do you write them a letter saying this, or do you call them? Like, what's the best point of contact?
Our advice is to put everything in writing. There's a sample letter to the utility that you can get on our website on the right-hand side, and you can use that and just modify it and basically send it certified mail. Go to the post office and get a certified mail slip, which shows, you know, if there's any future legal issues that you sent this denial of permission to have this device on your property, and that you gave them notice, and basically just get everything in writing, documents when it was installed, if you have any health symptoms, your you know, concerns about privacy. There's a great video on the internet, a guy named Jerry Day from Burbank, just this TV producer, just sat down and researched this issue and basically talks about how, really in detail, about how the smart meters affect and invade your privacy. People should check that out too. But definitely recommend that people do take action, talk to your neighbors, send in the letters. You know, a lot of electricians are sympathetic to this cause and will replace the analogs. And you know, I think PG&E, our utility in California, has begun just the first couple of replacements of smart meters with older, safer analog meters, and that's in response to direct requests of the Public Utilities Commission in person. You know, I think we're beginning to see the assumptions and the business model of the smart grid really begin to fall apart in a lot of different ways, and you know, we need to stand together and organize and refuse to be to give up our rights to the system, because it's really awful. And the more you investigate this issue and what the implications are of a wireless, particularly a wireless smart grid, you know, you're the more horrified you become, and the more you know, you want to get involved and organize and help to do stuff. But Facebook and Twitter and, you know, shows like yours, but we really need to get this out through the grassroots, because the media just isn't doing its job and is really, I would say at this point, actively suppressing these stories from coming forward.
Well, I ain't that media. You know, we're your buddy. We do.
You ain't. Yeah.
We're your buddy here at Waking Up Orwell. We have our do-it-yourself government. We have quite a few things on the list that we're going to add to our web. If we were on, say, like an FCC tower, we couldn't do like a direct call to action. We could ask you what to do, but we couldn't say, go here, do this, blah, blah, blah. So what we do is we put lists of different action items that come from different organizations that, you know, we basically kind of like sponsor by having them there, kind of like a media sponsor. And we sponsor good activism that supports people's privacy, asserting themselves in a healthy way where they have a choice between, say, like Monsanto genetically frankenfood corn and not. Or, you know, if the government's coming in and basically doing an aggressive seizure of your property, we give people clues as to, like, what to do about it. Okay, get smart. That's what stopsmartmeters.org has to say.
How's it? Get wise. Get wise and don't buy the smart.
Well, I really have enjoyed this conversation. We've been talking with Joshua Hart of stopsmartmeters.org. He's an organizer who's guiding others to finding their path to their rights, being better informed about the privacy violations and the health problems associated with smart meters. And it seems like, you know, you're either in one camp or the other. People who don't care about privacy won't do anything. But if it violates my child's health, hell yeah, I'll be showing up in spades. So pick your poison, because it's both really bad. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Sheila. It's been a pleasure. Keep fighting 1984.
Yes.
So what is he really talking about? He's talking about George Orwell's book called 1984. It's not the actual year 1984, because the actual year of 1984 was more innocent than, say, now. In the actual 1984, Madonna was competing with Duran Duran at the first MTV Video Awards. You know, people were running around with neon tights and leg warmers. David Lynch gave us Dune, and we didn't have the internet. So it was a really different time. What he's talking about is 2011. Government shutdowns, the run on your private data, and a top-heavy society so imbalanced and unwieldy, a great fall seems inevitable. Hence the evolution of an alternative news program, so hard-hitting, it is almost impossible to listen to without feeling physical pain. I am talking about the very show you are listening to right now, Waking Up Orwell. If Waking Up Orwell had to be categorized, it might be industrial or the metal grindcore of news. I'm going to invent a genre. I'm going to call it nervecore. And while we know it's niche, life gets more impossible if you ignore this show. When I take off the mask of niche radio announcer and producer, there is a really well-informed advocate working to empower you to overcome obstructions to your personal liberty. The afterglow of Waking Up Orwell is the Dusty 511 campaign. And while the machinery is present, the operating budget is not. And that is unfortunate. So what do we do? Well, let's barter for some airtime. You can take Waking Up Orwell from a decent show to a fantastic show by sending us comments, recommendations, promoting the show, sending it to your friends, and best of all, helping us find season sponsors for a land tower in the Seattle metro market. The price to air this show on a land tower station is more than we can ever afford. It's $12,000 a season for one weekend slot. It's not even a good slot. It's like a weekend slot. That breaks down to $500 an hour. However, we would prefer to pay it rather than deal with the internal station politics where people choose suppression and envy opposed to our heavy contrast set of news. In brief, we need you to help us making the jump to the next level. We're not a neat, clean, innocent show. We are dark, intense, witty, and unapologetic for producing content that isn't your 18 to 35 masculine demo. But we love our fans who are. This show swings around and knocks over political coverage boundaries because we allow interviewees to be themselves as they answer really tough questions in context of America fast becoming a public-private surveillance mall. Don't believe me? Flash mobs, hoodies, extra-large sunglasses, they're all pop culture's answers to the invasive CCTV and the criminalization of public assembly. America is sensitive to their liberties going away. Waking Up Orwell is what it sounds like when there's nerve damage to those sensitivities. We have to ask you to support us with your money. We agreed to generously produce content in lieu of advocating your better knowing at beatthechip.org, wakinguporwell.info, and our overflow blog, Godzilla Government. Here's how to support us. Visit 511campaign.org, that's 511campaign.org, and click the fundraising tab on the left-hand side. There you will find a donate button. When you donate $500, we will assign you your own air-dated program, because you bought us 1 hour of programming. If you want to mail us an analog donation, known as a check or money order, email us at beatthechip@gmail.com, and we will send you an address. If you love us, envy us, hate us, send money anyway. Deep down, you want to see us compete, if not win. The donation link will be posted on each episode until we are able to grab that air slot. So thank you for listening and supporting the show. And this also wraps this episode of Waking Up Orwell, which went pretty long. Stay up to date on interim news by adding us on Twitter at BeatTheChip. And subscribing to BeatTheChip.org, it's free. And subscribing to our Podomatic updates. Thank you so much for listening. And don't forget, everyone has power, especially you.